On July 9th, 1916, the New York Times puzzled over an emergent fashion trend. Europeans were starting to wear bracelets with clocks on them. Time had migrated to the human wrist, and the development required some explaining. Until recently, the paper observed, the bracelet watch has been looked upon by Americans as more or less of a joke. Vaudeville artists and moving picture actors have utilized it as a fun maker, as a, quote, silly ass fad. 99 years later, the Apple Watch was released. We've come a long way, baby. And now, instead of the rabbit from Alice in Wonderland clutching its pocket watch, exclaiming, I'm late, we are clutching our smartphones in Neanderthal-like posture, falling whim to every beep, buzz, and flash that notifies us that it's time to pay attention not to that which is right in front of us, but to some other small parcel of information. Be still and know that I am God, the psalmist writes. Be still, are you kidding me? There's so much to do in so little time. I woke up at 5 a.m. to go to the gym, to drive an hour to work, to hammer out 3 project proposals, to get home, whip up a quick meal, get to the kids, to soccer practice, ballet practice, bassoon practice, practice, only to get home and realize that the pipes have frozen. There's a leak in the basement and it's filling up with water. I'm sorry, you want me to be still? Should we be thankful that 1,500 years before the birth of Christ, some brilliant woman or man took a stick, stuck it in the ground, and began to mark where the shadows were cast during the day, creating, in essence, one of the world's first clocks? By the time of the Roman Empire, these sundials, as they were called, could be found everywhere, and so, too, could rigid adherence to clock time, much to the dismay of second-century Roman poet Plautus, who wrote, the gods confound man who first found out how to distinguish hours. Confound him, too, who in this place set up a sundial to cut and hack my day so wretchedly into small pieces. When I was a boy, my belly was my sundial. It was one more sure, truer, and more exact than any of them. This dial told me when 'twas proper time to go to dinner, when I ought to eat. The town's so full of these confounded dials. As a 3-year-old, I felt Plautus's palpable pain. My mother recently told me this story about a play date I had at my best friend Russell's house. We were having a grand old time with our favorite activity, pretending to be Ninja Turtles in his backyard. That is, until our playtime was rudely interrupted with that phrase so dreaded by any child. Come on, Cameron, it's time to go home. It's time to go home, says who? Clearly, it's time to play Ninja Turtles. Russell went dutifully inside, the time-respecting 3-year-old that he was. Me, I had other plans. You see, Russell's family lived in this old century home with wooden stairs up to a front porch that had a bit of a storage area underneath. I decided that the only way to prevent it from being time to go home was to hide under the porch. And so I hid. Patiently, I can't imagine what was running through my 3-year-old brain at the time, what sort of outcome was I looking for. But I sat in quiet stillness under the porch for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. The same time I could hear my parents and Russell's parents looking for me, calling my name, and I thought to myself, no way am I coming out, because if I do, then it's time to go home. At some point, it started to get dark, and I heard my mom say to Russell's mom, I think we should call the police. Now, let me tell you, that just got my 3-year-old's attention. I leapt out from under the porch and bounded up the stairs towards the front door where my mom was standing. Why are you calling the police? I asked. And then we went home, for the time had come. Like all kids, I hated restrictions that clocks put on my life. But are clocks really that bad? Shouldn't we be grateful that we can distinguish one hour from the next? Let's consider that the first mechanical clocks of any accuracy were designed to serve a rather noble purpose, as they allowed monks in 13th century Europe to observe their daily prayer times. Churches were also early adopters of mechanical clock technology, as they added bell towers to their buildings and appointed themselves responsible for telling time to their town. Quickly, however, this became a call both to prayer and work. And towards the end of the 19th century, a man named Willard Bundy realized just how important it was for factory managers to be able to keep track of and record workers' time on the job, and so he invented what became known as the punch clock. Suddenly 1 hour, 8 hours, 40 hours, they could all have a literal financial value, and that is what Benjamin Franklin was referring to when he wrote "Time is Money." An idle day off, Franklin argued, represented money lost in the form of potential earnings. The sociologist Lewis Mumford argued that the clock, and not the steam engine, is the key machine of the modern industrial age and remains a key machine of the information age. Our timekeeping devices parcel our lives into ever smaller pieces. Business meetings are timed to the minute. Speed daters try to make a connection in 3 minutes, and a couple seconds delay at a green light can result in pure, unbridled outrage. We've all been there. The clock, though it was designed to act as an anchor in time, has in many ways made us slaves to time. The movement of a clock's hands are a constant reminder that our lives, second by second, minute by minute, and hour by hour, are split away. Recently, the University of Memphis changed their motto from "dreamers, thinkers, doers" to "driven by doing." Hika Polster, a professor at the university, argues that this change reflects an alarming development in higher education and academic culture, namely that there is little time left for the careful cultivation of the imagination and the intellect. Meanwhile, Silicon Valley has become a beacon for flashy startups that worship at the altar of efficiency, saving you time at every turn. Brian Scudamore argued in a recent Globe and Mail article that we're living in a post-consumer world where time is a hotter commodity than money. He says people who value time over money are really after one thing: freedom. They want to hire somebody to wash their car, paint their house, deliver their groceries, cook dinner, you name it, so that they have the time to do what they want. Now, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong about buying back our time. However, it's clear that our relationship with time has grown ever more neurotic. We want to be smarter, fitter, healthier, sexier, funnier, and more sophisticated, and we want to get there as fast as possible. I have been told that I project a calm outer presence. Well, let me tell you this. Beneath my thin outer veneer of calm is an impatience so fierce that I have finished an entire advent calendar worth of chocolates by the 6th of December. It's an impatience so overwhelming that I say the quickest prayers before mealtimes. It's an impatience so all-encompassing that I have the occasional urge to push slow walkers out of the way. I swear, I'm not a bad person. But sometimes the need for speed is overwhelming. Earlier this week, on the way to work, I drove past a sign that said, "Only 11 more sleeps." My first thought was not, "Oh my goodness, I'm so excited." No, it was, "Say it ain't so, there's so much to do in so little time." And guess what? Now there are only 9 more sleeps. I was upset at the reminder that the celebration of Christ's birth is upon us. Why? Because somewhere in all the busyness of the season, I lost sense of my wonder, joy, and expectation. I can remember counting the sleeps till Christmas when I was a kid. 10 sleeps, 9, 8, 7, until Christmas Eve, when I was so brimming with excitement and enthusiasm that I could not contain myself. And it's a good thing that on that Christmas Eve we got to open our stockings before we went to bed. Now Christmas arrives and I breathe a sigh of relief. I breathe that sigh of relief that I made it through the pre-Christmas craziness. I think our pre-Christmas craziness obscures our ability to observe the season of Advent, in which we are supposed to wait expectantly for the birth of Christ. But most of us have already started celebrating. The holiday season begins long before December 25th. As a result, we move too quickly into celebrating Christmas before it even arrives. Let's face it. The parties are at their peak at the very same time that the church is asking us to take an Advent posture, slow and careful reflection. Instead, Advent becomes a season of mulled wine, awkward office parties, and fruitcakes. And I don't know about you, but I really dislike fruitcake. Be still and know. So why is it so hard to take on an Advent posture of stillness and waiting? In his book, In Praise of Slowness, Challenging the Cult of Speed, Carl Honoré writes, "Like a bee in a..." flower bed, the human brain naturally flits from one thought to the next. In the high-speed workplace where data and headlines come at us thick and fast, we are all under pressure to think quickly. Reaction rather than reflection is the order of the day. And to make the most of our time and to avoid boredom, we fill up every spare moment with mental stimulation. Reaction rather than reflection is the order of the day. But what does it mean to reflect when there is so much in life to react to? What does it mean to be still in this information age? Are you suffering from distraction sickness like I am? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and after 6 days of busyness creating, God took a seventh day to rest, a day of Sabbath. To me, this passage is a reminder that we do not own time, the time that exists between our first breath and our last is a gift. And if time is a gift given to us, it is a gift we can give to others. As a gift, it is not something to be hoarded or something to be sold for gain or profit. The notion of Sabbath is thus particularly countercultural in a world in which time, even in its smallest subdivisions, is treated often as money. The call to Sabbath is then a call to give up time to rest, reflect, and relinquish the burden of needing to be productive. Simply put, the call to Sabbath is a call to slow down. In other religious traditions, the need to slow down is also present. The Babylonians had holy days on the 7th, 14th, 21st, and 28th of every month. In Theravada Buddhism, the Upasatha is observed every 7 or 8 days. This, Buddha taught, was for the cleansing of the defiled mind. In Cherokee tradition, the first day of the new moon beginning at sunrise is a holiday of quiet reflection and prayer. So to observe Sabbath is to quiet our cluttered minds. It is to acknowledge that we are human beings and not human doings. To observe Sabbath is to quietly ask the question, how can I reconcile my relationship with time? Be still and know. The 1973 fantasy novel Momo offers some answers to the question of what it might mean to live a reconciled relationship with time. Written by Michael Ende, who is more famous for A Never-Ending Story, its title character Momo is a young orphan girl. And though Momo is poor and shabby, she has one form of wealth, and that is time. In everything she does, she exudes patience and serenity. She becomes the go-to person that the people of her town come to with their problems, and she listens to them with her whole being. Into the midst of this happy, quiet, communal life of Momo's town, the gray men appear. With suits, briefcases, cigars, and ashen faces, they set about instructing the townspeople to be more efficient by eliminating pointless activities like socializing, creating, and daydreaming. The men in gray promise to deposit the extra time in a bank for later use, but secretly, they're stealing it for themselves. And as Momo's friends and neighbors scramble to save time at all costs, their lives begin to lose meaning. Soon, the town is but a shadow of its former self, and only Momo can save it, because only Momo seems to be immune to the men in gray's time-stealing tricks. Towards the end of the book, Momo is brought by her mentor, Master Hora, to a domed hall where a pendulum is swinging over a lake. And as it does so, the pendulum coaxes a unique flower out of the water each time it swings one way, and then causes it to wilt, decay, and die as it swings back. This poignant scene, Master Hora tells Momo, takes place in the depths of your own heart. Each of these flowers specific to a person in the village, and they are being stolen by the men in gray who freeze-dry them and roll them into cigars to smoke. This is literally sucking the lifeblood out of the townspeople, one by one. Master Hora describes the loss of these flowers as a kind of disease. He says, you feel more and more bad-tempered, more and more empty inside, more and more dissatisfied with yourself and with the world in general. And in the end, these flowers, called the hour lilies, are all the people have of value. And at the end of the story, Momo is called to defeat the men in gray using a single one of these flowers, which are lilies, and they represent a single hour of time that cannot be stolen. A lily representing a single hour of time. It sounds scripturally familiar. In Matthew 6, Jesus is telling his followers to stop being so anxious about their lives. Verse 27, "And which of you by being anxious can add a single hour to their lifespan? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil or spin, yet I tell you, even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you?" So this morning, as winter is upon us, Christmas draws near, and our lives grow as frenetic as ever, let us consider the lilies. Let us consider the many wonders of life that there is never time to stop and revel in. Let yourself be filled with awe the next time you interact with a baby. Consider the way it was miraculously knit together in its mother's womb. Consider the mystery that allows life to flourish, that allows us to be sustained. Because to allow yourself to succumb to awe allows your concept of time to be transcended. The average person only feels awe 2 to 3 times per week. This is the direct result of a self-obsessed and overworked culture. It's clear we need to slow down and look outside of ourselves. In her book, When the Heart Waits, Sue Monk Kidd talks about going on a retreat at a monastery and observing a monk sitting perfectly still. When she asked him how he could bear just sitting there and doing nothing, he said, "When you are waiting, you are not doing nothing. You are doing the most important thing there is. You are allowing your soul to grow up. If you can't be still and wait, you can't become the person that God created you to be." I'll be honest with you. Being still and waiting is incredibly difficult for me, and it's not just because I am a terribly impatient person. It's because when I am still, my mind often wanders to dark places. For me, this Richard Rohr quote rings true. He says, "If you really sit in the silence and refuse to feed your compulsive style of thinking, what comes up are unhealed hurts, past unresolved relationships, all the things you don't want to see about yourself. And for me, what often emerges is deep depression. This is a place where time is warped to the point where it doesn't really seem to move at all, where there's little hope, it seems, of ever moving forward once again. And when I sense that I am heading towards a period of depression, my default is to occupy myself with as many activities and distractions as I can so that I don't have time to acknowledge the broken state of my interior life. It's as if I think by maintaining a frenetic pace of life, I will be able to offset the time-warping nature of depression. It doesn't work. Sooner or later, I am forced to come face to face with those deep, dark parts of myself that I would rather ignore. These are wilderness moments, and I suspect each of you here this morning has your own wilderness story to tell. Perhaps a relationship broken down, perhaps a loved one passed away too soon, perhaps a serious illness faced. And some of these hurts and pains become especially apparent in this lead up to Christmas, this season of Advent, because Advent is truly a wilderness season, one of waiting, longing, and despair. In my day job, I have the privilege of walking alongside various faith communities as they sponsor refugees and welcome them into their neighborhoods. And as part of this work, I read countless refugee stories. These are among the most profound wilderness narratives that I have ever encountered. Each of the world's 25 million refugees lives in waiting. During this Advent season, I think of the stories of countless Eritreans who have fled the horrors of perpetual military service in their country. If they manage to flee the military and cross the Eritrean border alive, they arrive in Sudan and head for the city of Khartoum to look for any sort of work to allow them to survive, to eke out an existence. But most keep moving as Eritrean government spies fill that city. Many refugees in this situation are then forced to connect with loved ones back home and ask them to send their life savings in order that they can hire human smugglers who take them through the Sinai Desert in Egypt on a journey completed largely by foot. This is the most precarious existence you can imagine. Some smugglers will hold Eritrean men and women ransom at various encampments throughout the desert, demanding more money and inflicting brutal torture and solitary confinement until the money comes. If they are lucky, these refugees will arrive in Israel. But lucky in this case is only a relative term, for the Israeli government's attitude towards refugees is downright racist. Many are detained, and all are forced to give a sizable portion of any meager earnings they make to the government, only to be returned if they leave Israel. Consider for a moment that out of 40,000 African asylum seekers in Israel right now, only 4 Sudanese and 10 Eritreans have been granted refugee status. The rest, their journey is halted, and they continue to live a wilderness experience. This wilderness experience is one that I have talked to many Syrian refugees about. They arrive to host countries such as Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, countries that are severely under-resourced in their ability to accommodate, never mind integrate, millions of refugees. And so these Syrian women, men, and children wait in hope of a fated phone call, one in which they are told that they have been selected for resettlement to a country where they might be afforded full legal rights and the opportunity to perhaps rebuild a sense of home. Recently, I helped a Jewish community submit a refugee sponsorship application for 5 Syrian siblings currently seeking asylum in Turkey. The youngest sibling, we'll call him Ahmed, is currently 16. He was 10 when he fled Syria with his older siblings after their parents were killed. Nearly a third of Ahmed's life has been spent in waiting, and as I went to submit his application, I noticed something for the first time. In the professional photograph of him to be submitted to the government, he was wearing a gray t-shirt. On it, but written in mirror reverse, were the words, "Never give up." I like to believe that Ahmed bought this shirt purposefully, so that every time he looks in the mirror, he comes face to face with 3 determined words of hope. Never give up. Ahmed's story is an Advent story. It is a story captured in the words of Isaiah 40, which read, "A voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all people will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken, a voice says, cry out, and I said, what shall I cry? All people are like grass, and all their faithfulness is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flowers fall, because of the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God endures forever." The passage ends with the following words of hope, and every time I read them, I can't help but think of Ahmed and his young, determined resilience. Passage reads, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God and the creator of the ends of the earth. They will not grow weary or tired, and his understanding no one can fathom. Gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men such as Ahmed stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." So what does it mean to prepare the way of the Lord, just as this passage reads, just as it was fulfilled by John the Baptist? I believe this preparation must start within ourselves. It starts with a quieting of our hearts and minds and a ridding of our idols of busyness and distraction. There is much wisdom in the practices of contemplation, meditation, and self-compassion, whatever those might look like for you. I know what you're thinking, and I can say that for me, that definitely does not look like yoga. Honestly, I couldn't do yoga to save my life, which, you think about it, is a very strange scenario. As far as I know, there are no life-saving yoga poses. But for you, yoga may be an answer, and that's okay. Or perhaps it's some form of mindfulness practice. But for me, meditation simply means being attuned and present to the world around me. It means experiencing the world through my senses and not always through a screen. It means acknowledging how much of a gift it is to be alive and breathing deeply in the ineffable experience of awe. It means slowing down my pace to the point where I'm living one breath in, one breath out, over and over and over. One way I'm trying to do this is on my commute to and from work, an hour each way. Generally, during my commute, I listen to podcasts. Once in a while lately, I try to just embrace silence. It is a challenge because there's part of me that thinks I could be using this time to learn something or laugh at something or be distracted by something. But there's also something powerful about just doing nothing. I can't say for certain that my soul is growing up while I drive to Burlington and back in my 2012 Ford Focus, but it might just be. Be still and know. There are 623 instances of the word time in the Bible, and when we think of time, we think of chronological time. In Greek, this word was written in the New Testament as chronos. But there was another word in Greek that referred to deep time or the fullness of time, and that was kairos. This is the word for moments in which you say to yourself, this is as perfect as it gets, or I understand things now, or this moment sums up the last 3 years of my life. In kairos, time comes to a fullness and the dots start to connect. Richard Rohr suggests that the practice of contemplation is deeply enmeshed with this concept and experience of kairos. We see one kairos moment after another in the Christmas story. Luke 2 starts with the words, in those days Caesar Augustus issued a decree, and it continues with a description of the shepherds tending their flocks being visited by angels and told to go to Bethlehem. After this, the passage reads, they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. This was a kairos moment for the shepherds. They are experiencing profound depth. But it is the moment and passage that follows that is my favorite. It says, but Mary treasured up all of these things and pondered them in her heart. Let's be honest, Mary has had a very busy go of it to this point. She's traveled from Nazareth to Judea, very pregnant. Her and Joseph arrived there and couldn't find a hotel room on account of the census, and were offered a stable as a place to rest their heads. And while in that stable, a time came for the baby to be born. Just as Mary's trying to get a bit of rest, a pile of shepherds come marching by wanting to see the baby. You gotta see the baby. What a year, I can imagine Mary saying to herself, very deeply pondering all of these things. The depth of her experience transcends time. Embracing stillness and celebrating these type of kairos moments in life sounds attractive until your mind wanders, as it might be now, to your endless to-do list. But really, I'm not suggesting we figure out a way to drop life's responsibilities, because there's a difference between waiting patiently and sitting idly by. We wait expectantly for Christmas, but we are still active in preparing our hearts, minds, and homes for it. Likewise, as we wait expectantly for God's kingdom to be made new, we should live lives and make space both in our world and in our hearts for this possibility for this wholeness to enter in. To believe in the promise of Christ's birth in the midst of a broken world is to have what in German is called Sehnsucht. It's one of those amazing and untranslatable words that has no equivalent in the English language. Of it, Lucas Coya says, the best way I could describe it is as a quick physical burst of energy that contains in it intense feelings of beauty, love, familiarity, tenderness, sadness, and an overwhelming sense of reality and longing, all occurring simultaneously. Or as C.S. Lewis puts it, our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door that we have always seen from the outside, is no more neurotic fancy, but the truest index of our real situation. And to be at last summoned inside would be both glory and honor beyond our merits, and the healing of that old nostalgic ache. Advent is a time of deep longing and despair for that which nothing in time, nothing on earth, no creature can fully satisfy, because we are made for timelessness. 13th century Persian poet Rumi beautifully captured this desire to be connected with the divine reality that our hectic daily lives cut us off from. He writes, what was said to the rose that made it open was said to me here in my chest. What was told the cypress that made it strong and straight. What was whispered the jasmine. So it is what it is. Whatever made sugarcane sweet, whatever was said to the inhabitants of the town of Shigil in Turkestan that makes them so handsome, whatever lets the pomegranate flower blush like a human face, that is being said to me now. I blush. Whatever put eloquence in language, that's happening here. The great warehouse doors open. I fill with gratitude, chewing a piece of sugar cane, in love with the one to whom every that belongs. So in the season of hustle and bustle, let us set our clocks aside once in a while. Let us open ourselves up to these poignant moments of Sehnsucht, points in time which defy the logic of time itself and urge us towards a holy impatience as we seek to bring about glimpses of the kingdom here and now. And in the stillness of these moments, may we find the strength and courage to act against the gray men in our own lives. May we be Momo to a world in need of a new ethic of time. May we be still and know. As these words appear upon the screen, I invite you to quiet your hearts and minds and reflect in stillness.